From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Dr. Stephen C. Meyer, director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, and author of Return of the God Hypothesis, three scientific discoveries that reveal the mind behind the universe. Now let's join Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Stephen Meyer in their conversation.
It's now well established that the spherical nature of the Earth was well known in the Middle Ages and even before. And these revisionist works of history of science in the late 19th century, the warfare between science and Christianity and by Draper and White, these were appallingly bad pieces of historiography, even at the time. Yes, there was some tension at the time between the Darwinians and Orthodox Jews and Christians about the creation of life, but that was by no means the dominant feature of the interaction between people of faith and scientists. In fact, many scientists, as I pointed out, were profoundly religious people who were doing science for profoundly religious reasons. There's a great book by the historian of science, Rodney Stark, who was here at the University of Washington for many years, where I am in Seattle, and then now at Baylor University, called For the Glory of God. And it's a history of the scientific revolution published by Princeton University Press. This is well known now to historians of science. The religious contribution to the origins of modern science is well known and documented by leading historians of science. So these late 19th century revisionist works, as well as these popularizations that we get in things like the reboot of the Cosmos series or the original Cosmos series by Neil deGrasse Tyson or before him Carl Sagan, this is a really appallingly bad history of science when we tell the public that science and religion are at war or that religious ideas are science stoppers and the like.
In your book, you highlight three metaphors that are used to describe nature during the scientific revolution. And I want to go through each one of those, starting with the book of nature. One of the things I've pointed out in my own writings is something that Albert Einstein said with respect to the book of nature. He said he saw himself as a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many different languages. The child knows someone must have written those books. It does not know how. It does not understand the languages in which those books were written. The child dimly suspects a mysterious order in the arrangement of the books, but it doesn't know what it is. That said, Albert Einstein, that, it seems to me, is the attitude of even the most intelligent human being toward God. And of course, as I've pointed out, Einstein rejected the personal God of the Bible, but he did revere the God who gives glimpses of himself in the library of nature. That by way of prologue to your discussion of the book of nature.
I absolutely love that quotation. I wanted to use it, but the publishers thought I was encumbering my second chapter with too much stuff. So we cut that, but it's a lovely quote. And it shows that Einstein believed in a God with a mind. It wasn't a completely impersonal God, but it was a God with a mind of some kind. And there was a mind behind the universe. But that metaphor of the book of nature goes back to the period of the scientific revolution and before into late medieval theology. You find that metaphor being used by St. Thomas Aquinas. And the idea there is simple, that just as God reveals himself through the book of Scripture, he also reveals himself through the book of nature. Nature is revelatory of the reality and the mind of God. And that metaphor also underscored this notion of intelligibility, that just as we can read the book of Scripture and understand it, we can read the book of nature and understand it. And therefore, this gives impetus to the empirical investigation of the natural world. A second metaphor was in common currency. And here, the use of these metaphors actually seals the case for the theological inspiration of modern science. The other big one was the idea of the laws of nature. There are laws of nature, there are orderly patterns that we can describe in a law-like way because there is a lawgiver and a sustainer of the orderly concourse of the universe, namely God. And the third metaphor that was commonly used was the idea of a clock. And this was not used as a deistic idea that God set things up in motion and let them run. It was later perhaps co-opted by deists, but it was used to convey the idea of design, that just as a clock has many different parts that function in a coordinated fashion to achieve an overall end, nature and specific natural systems, like clocks, have many integrated parts that allow them to function in a way that performs an overall function or achieves an end. And the different parts of nature function together in much the way different parts of a clock do. So you had the universe as a clock, the universe as a book, and the universe as a lawful realm, all of which conveyed this deep theological inspiration for doing science in the first place.
How did we get from someone like Newton to someone like Dawkins, from the idea that intelligent design is self-evident to the notion that intelligent design is absurd, so absurd that it is in fact rendered delusion? In other words, what I'd like you to do is expand on the enormous intellectual shift that has taken place in Western civilization from the founding of modern science to where we are today.
Right. Well, there's two main phases of that, and it's a huge story, of course, but I try to distill it as best I can in the third chapter of my book. The first phase of the shift occurs in philosophy before we really get to science. In the Enlightenment, the idea is that whereas previously Christian thinkers believed that reason was a gift of God and it was best used in dependence on revelation and a dependence on assumptions that made sense in light of a Judeo-Christian worldview, the Enlightenment philosophers thought that reason could be used autonomously from God. And they also, many of them, Hume in particular, argued that many of the classical proofs for the existence of God were invalid. They didn't work. And this shift in philosophy is taking place in the 18th century. In the 19th century, we begin to see the impact of that way of thinking on the practice of science itself, as scientific theories are proposed to explain the origin of different features of life in the physical universe apart from any God hypothesis. So there's a famous, probably apocryphal tale that is told of an encounter between Napoleon and the French physicist Pierre Laplace. Napoleon did summon Laplace to his palace in 1802 to commend him for a work on the origin of the solar system called the Celestial Mechanics. And he did apparently ask Laplace about why he didn't mention God in his scientific work in the way that Sir Isaac Newton did. The apocryphal part probably is the oft-quoted answer that Laplace is said to have given, where he puffs himself up and says, "Sir, I have no need of that hypothesis." Well, William Herschel, the great English astronomer, was present at the meeting, and his description doesn't include that quote, but it does convey that Laplace had that sort of an attitude, that he was attempting to explain everything without reference to God. And he was attempting to do the very thing that Newton said could not be done in the General Scholium to the Principia. Newton said that you could explain the ongoing movement of the planets by reference to the law of gravity, but you couldn't explain the original position of the planets, the sun, the comets, the fine tuning of that system by the mere law of gravity alone. Laplace attempted to do that. Then in geology, you had figures like Lyell and others who were attempting to explain the origin of the great mountains and canyons and river deltas by reference to slow, gradual, undirected processes. Many of those explanations were perfectly sufficient, but they also captured the same spirit of the age of sort of godless explanations for the origin of things. And then Darwin came along and attempted to explain the origin of new forms of life by natural selection rather than by an act of divine creation. And so by the end of the 19th century, you have this quite seamless account of natural history, going back to the origin of the solar system, to planet Earth, to the origin of new forms of life, eventually even human life, and even the origin of the first life itself out of the primordial prebiotic soup. And so there's a kind of seamless narrative that accounts for everything with no need of the God hypothesis. And that, plus shifts in philosophy, convince most intellectuals, as Richard Dawkins has said, that Well, God might exist, but his existence is rendered extremely improbable by all these otherwise materialistic explanations.
Something else you do in your book that I think is instructive is you talk about the lack of Christian unity and how this lack of unity, this religious conflict that was pitting Catholics against Protestants and so forth, actually was a negative influence in the shift towards scientific materialism.
Well, right. In the wake of the religious wars of the 16th, 17th, and even 18th century, there was a shift away from specific doctrinal affirmations towards a more generic kind of deism that eventually evolved, if you will, into a more completely naturalistic worldview.
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Stephen Meyer. Is there a God? After the 18th century, many powerful voices advanced the perception that science and Christian belief are at war, with scientific materialists proclaiming that science leaves no room for belief in God. In Return of the God Hypothesis, Dr. Stephen Meyer explains three scientific discoveries that revealed the mind behind the universe, indeed, a personal God. Return of the God Hypothesis offers breakthrough evidence of the ultimate mystery of the universe that will change the way you view the world around you forever. To receive your copy of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org. Endless predictions about end-time events and published timetables counting down the end have proven to be wrong 100% of the time. When doomsday predictions fail, there is double-duty damage. Many theologically juvenile and scripturally superficial Christians abandon the faith as a result of these failed predictions, and the public image of Christianity is damaged, making Christians appear to be hopelessly naive and easily duped biblical bumpkins. Hank Hanegraaff's book, Prophetic Stars in the Constellation of Biblical Prophecy, will equip you not only to interpret biblical prophecy correctly, but to remember it as well. To receive your copy of Prophetic Stars as our thank you for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
Many intellectuals insist that science and belief in God are at war. In Return of the God Hypothesis, Stephen Meyer argues that theism, with its affirmation of a transcendent, intelligent, and active creator, best explains the evidence we have concerning biological and cosmological origins. Previously, Meyer refrained from attempting to answer questions about who might have designed life. Now he provides an evidence-based answer to the ultimate mystery of the universe. The results? Meyer reveals a stunning conclusion. The data support not just the existence of an intelligent designer of some kind, but the existence of a personal God. To receive your copy of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Dr. Stephen Meyer, as they continue their conversation.
In the wake of the religious wars of the 16th, 17th, and even 18th century, there was a shift away from specific doctrinal affirmations towards a more generic kind of deism that eventually evolved, if you will, into a more completely naturalistic worldview. So you went from a theistic worldview where God was viewed as the creator and a God who was both transcendent and active in the creation, to a deistic worldview where God might have set things in motion but had nothing to do with the universe and human affairs after the beginning of the universe, to a view where God likely did not exist at all. And some of this was simply an emotional or reflexive, aversive response to the distasteful and troubling wars that took place between Christians of different doctrinal affiliations. If doctrine is causing wars, let's get rid of doctrine, I think was the kind of the spirit. So, yeah, I think that's part of the story for sure.
Well, one of the things that I will criticize your book for, in fact, I'll even call it criminal, is that you take the best, the most concise refutation of David Hume, the refutation of his famed argument against miracles, and you relegate that to a footnote.
Well, I'm a huge critic of Hume, so I could obviously have said a lot more. But to me, his argument against miracles is itself criminal. It's so bad because he, on the one hand, claims that the laws of nature are nothing more than habits of the mind. They don't reflect anything real about the natural world. And then he turns around and says that these laws of nature, which he has already relegated to a status in philosophy is called ontological. The laws of nature have no ontological status. Then he turns around and says, but they can stop miracles from happening. If laws of nature are only ideas in our own minds, then they can't stop anything from happening in nature, whether miraculous or otherwise. So I accept your point, Hank. I could have said a lot more about that.
But, no, it was tongue-in-cheek, obviously. But what I was trying to say was that getting your book is worthwhile not only for reading its content, but also for reading every one of the footnotes, because here you have this incredible refutation of David Hume, and it's relegated to a footnote.
Well, there was a sweet lady who came up to me at a conference, and it might have been the conference that I sometimes attend in Charlotte, and she said, well, my husband loves your books, and he's even read all of the footnotes. And I said, well, I really apologize. I'm very sorry. You've been made an intelligent design widow, you know.
I do want to mention for everybody listening in that your book, an incredible resource, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web. For your support, simply go to the web at equip.org. You can also write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. So you can go to the web, equip.org. You can write me, or you can talk to our resource consultants, 888-7000, and the letters CRI. There's so much in this book that's important for us to absorb. Because this is, and again, I want to go back before we continue the discussion somewhat, go back to the significance of this subject. This is not just a subject. I used to say it's not just an apologetic argument. This is the apologetic argument. How one views their origins ultimately will determine how they live their life. Expand on that.
Well, the origins theories function as surrogates for larger worldviews. They don't exactly prove, say, theism versus materialism. But if you accept, for example, Darwinian evolution plus chemical evolution plus the multiverse, you're pretty much on your way to adopting a wholesale materialistic worldview, because you've attempted to give an account of how everything arose by purely undirected material processes. And given the application of Occam's razor, you really needn't posit anything else to explain things. And so the simplest explanation, if you accept the adequacy of those explanations in combination, is really a universe in which there is no God. And that's exactly the kind of argument that Richard Dawkins, Stephen Hawking, and others have made, that the simplest explanation in light of those, the presumption of the adequacy of those theories is that there is no God. On the other hand, if you see that there's evidence of actual design in life or the universe, evidence of design that arises long after the universe in life, evidence of design from the very beginning of the universe in the, say, fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry, in other words, if you accept the kind of argument that I make in the book, that perspective on origins has implications that are affirmative of theism. Then all kinds of things flow from those two competing worldview perspectives. If you're a materialist, as Alex Rosenberg stated in the quote you gave earlier in the interview, you can't really affirm an objective distinction between right and wrong. What we mean by moral propositions are just instincts that were programmed into us by the evolutionary process. Morality is not a matter of an objective standard above us all to which we can appeal. Rather, it's just my preference or your preference about how we think things ought to be. We end up with a relativistic system of ethics most commonly. We also have a very hard time affirming any ultimate meaning to human existence because there's no personal source or purpose behind the universe. We are the product of a cosmic accident or two along the way. And when we die, we rot. And there's nothing about our personhood that will persist beyond our physical death. And so it's hard to imagine that anything we achieve will have any lasting value or meaning beyond the few people who might remember our achievements for a short period of time after we die. On the other hand, theism does provide a basis for understanding an objective difference between right and wrong. It provides an objective basis for morality. It affirms the ultimate meaning of a human person because each person is made in the image of God, and that God is personal. And if that God also has the potential to confer life everlasting, then there is a possibility of eternal life in a meaningful relationship between persons. Again, meaning is something conferred by persons, and I would say is best found in relationship between persons. So a personal, purposive source for the universe gives rise to a very different view of the ultimate significance of human life and existence. And you can follow that chain of logic right down the line. Very hard to account for the reliability of the human mind on what's called naturalistic epistemology. If we're the product of undirected, unguided material processes that only maximize survival rather than truth, then the minds we have may be no better than those of the lower animals or even the insects, who are surviving quite fine, thank you very much. Whereas if you accept theism, you have good reason to believe that the rational God who made our minds and who also made the world intended our minds as reliable instruments to know his creation. And therefore, there's a basis for epistemological realism, for believing in the reliability of the mind and our ability to know the world. So I think there are huge philosophical consequences and practical consequences in life as to whether one adopts a materialistic or a theistic worldview. And I think the great news is that the evidence actually supports a theistic worldview, and a theistic worldview, I think, confers a much greater sense of meaning and purpose on human existence. Or if a theistic worldview is true, there is a possibility of finding genuine meaning and purpose in relation to other persons and in relation to the personal God who made us.
You've mentioned the phrase fine-tuning a number of times in this discussion, and I want you to expand on how scientific materialists explain this fine-tuning, particularly when they use the idea of a multiverse. Assess that idea, that hypothesis.
Well, right. The multiverse, again, is the idea that there are many, many, many other universes out there. In fact, so many that in one of them, the combination of physical parameters would have to be set just right somewhere to allow for the possibility of life, and we just happen to be in the lucky universe. Remember, the ultimate fact that needs to be explained is the immense improbability associated with getting these many separate and independent fine-tuning parameters set just right to allow for a life-conducive universe. You fiddle with a cosmological constant by a tiny smidge one way or another, and you either get a heat death of the universe where all the matter and energy of the universe becomes too diffuse to allow for even stable galaxies and rocky planets, or if you fiddle with it in the other direction, you get a giant collapse and a black hole universe. And it doesn't take much of a fiddling of the dial to produce either of these adverse effects, and that applies not only to the cosmological constant, but to many, many other fine-tuning parameters. And so the multiverse is an attempt to explain the improbability associated with getting all the dials set to the right settings, if you will, by positing the existence of many, many other universes.
Well, we'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Our daily commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. With the new atheists increasing their mockery of Christianity, and militant secularism ridiculing religious convictions of all stripes, we clearly don't need zealous but misguided Christians inviting further abuse by misreading and misrepresenting biblical prophecies. Hank Hanegraaff's book, Prophetic Stars in the Constellation of Biblical Prophecy, will enable you to understand, remember, and communicate biblical prophecy. Moreover, your investment in Prophetic Stars through the Christian Research Institute will equip and encourage eager Christian brothers and sisters who genuinely yearn for truth and reliable tools to apprehend and defend their faith. To receive your copy of Prophetic Stars as our thank you for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org.